Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Southern Gothic is a podcast that explores the history behind some of the American South's darkest days, greatest mysteries, and most chilling ghost stories. At approximately 10 a.m., on November 10, 1865, Confederate Captain Henry Veers prepared to take his final walk to the gallows with a swig of whiskey and a chew of tobacco. Major G.B. Russell, Provost Marshal of the District of Columbia, then led the condemned man from his cell to the prison yard alongside Reverend Fathers Boyle and Wiggett, the prison commander Captain G.R. Waldbridge, and an armed guard. Over 200 spectators watched as they exited the old Capitol prison, and Veers was ushered to the scaffold where the 41-year-old Confederate officer took a seat on a small stool, which was located directly below the noose that would soon be around his neck. Seven other men had already met their fate on these exact gallows, but none of their executions were attended by even close to as many men as this. You see, Captain Veers had the distinction of being the only Confederate official to be executed following the Civil War, punishment for what today we would call war crimes that he committed while serving as the commander of Camp Sumter, the now notorious Andersonville prison. There, in the final 14 months of the Civil War, about 45,000 U.S. troops were held captive in extreme, inhumane conditions that ultimately led to the death of nearly 13,000 of them, a ghastly percentage of lives lost that was more than double those at other camps. So it's no wonder why so many men came to watch Veers hang that day, and the vast majority of them were survivors of the prison themselves. Of course, it wasn't just those allowed into the yard who watched. The Baltimore Sun reported, quote, "The walls of the prison, the adjoining housetops, and the trees in the street and the Capitol grounds were loaded with curious spectators who indulged in a variety of outcries, not calculated to inspirit the criminal in his last moments." Then, after Father Boyle recited several prayers over the convicted man, Major Russell stepped to the front of the scaffold and proceeded to read the order, findings of the court, and death sentence signed personally by President Andrew Johnson.
"And the court do therefore sentence him, Henry Veers, to be hanged by the neck until he be dead, at such time and place as the President of the United States may direct, 2/3 of the members of the court concurring therein. And the court also find the prisoner, Henry Veers, guilty of having caused the death in the manner as alleged in Specification 11, Charge 2, by means of dogs of 3 prisoners of war in his custody and soldiers of the United States. 1, occurring on or about the 15th day of May, 1864. Another occurred on or about the 11th day of July, 1864. Another occurring on or about the first day of September, 1864, but which finding as here expressed as not and did not enter into the sentence of the court as before given.
Major Russell concluded at about 10:25, and he then offered Veers a chance to make a final statement. The Confederate captain turned him down as shouting from the crowd escalated. Veers' hands and legs were then bound by straps. The noose was positioned around his neck, and at exactly 10:32 in the morning, the bolts were pulled and the trap door sprung open, leaving the infamous Andersonville jailer dangling in the air. The trial and subsequent execution of Captain Veers received national attention, bringing widespread awareness to the atrocities committed at Andersonville Prison, which to this very day is remembered as one of the deadliest places in the entire United States during the already violent and bloody American Civil War. My name is Brandon Schexnider, and you are listening to Southern Gothic.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
In February of 1864, the first 400 prisoners of war arrived at Andersonville Prison, or Camp Sumter as it was officially known, from Belle Isle in Richmond, Virginia. Overcrowding had become an issue at the prisons in the Confederate capital city, where most of the POWs were being detained in places like converted warehouses. And with no end to the war in sight, the citizens of Richmond were not only growing weary of the strain that these prisons put on their resources, but also feared the possibility of a prisoner or slave revolt. As a result, Confederate Captain W. Sidney Wilder was charged with the task of finding a new location for the captured Union soldiers, a place where the prisoners could be guarded by fewer men, supplies would be more accessible, and the location would make it more difficult for a potential military raid. So, a location just outside of the town of Andersonville, Georgia, was selected. The site was ideal. It was not only deep behind Confederate lines and surrounded by both swampland and woods, but the town also had a railroad station. Of course, locals didn't like the idea of this being in their backyard, but the Confederacy pressed on, and 900 enslaved men were brought in to build a stockade out of locally sourced pine wood. The 15-foot-high walls that they constructed originally enclosed 16.5 acres of land, but by the following summer, it ended up at 26.5 acres, and the resulting parallelogram-shaped structure measured about 1,620 feet long by 779 feet wide. Inside these walls, which quite honestly looked like nothing more than a log cabin-like fence, there were no buildings or barracks for the prisoners. It was merely a field with a small stream running through it that served as both the prisoners' water source and bathing location. Pigeon roosts, which were places for sentries, were also constructed about every 30 yards along the perimeter of the stockade, so these sentries were able to overlook the ground below. And approximately 19 feet from the exterior walls, a lighter fence known as a deadline was erected from rough-hewn logs and stakes driven into the ground. This 16-foot-high fence allowed guards to move freely around the edges of the camp, as prisoners were not allowed to cross or even touch the deadline. If they did, they were shot without warning. And y'all, yes, according to Merriam-Webster, this is the origin of our modern word, deadline. Well, over the 14 months that it was in operation, a modest force of about 1,000 to 3,000 Confederate soldiers guarded Andersonville Prison. They were mostly fresh recruits and volunteers, and they lived in a small military camp just outside the stockade walls. In addition, they dug out earthen forts to accommodate artillery as a defensive measure just in case the U.S. Army ever made its way this far into Confederate territory to threaten the camp. Yet, when the first 400 prisoners arrived on February 24, 1864, construction of the stockade had not yet been completed, and supply issues had already begun, a problem that only grew exponentially over time. In fact, according to a letter from the camp's quartermaster sent to his superiors a week before those first prisoners got there, some of the guards from the 26th Alabama Infantry and the 55th Georgia Infantry didn't even have guns. But, according to the Macon Telegraph, when that first group of POWs entered the camp and they saw the newly cleared field and stream running through it, they were, quote, delighted with this change from Richmond. You see, they had already been living in pretty awful and overcrowded conditions, and for that single brief moment, their new accommodations offered hope. Tragically, though, this did not last for long, as almost immediately that small stream that ran through the prison, known as the Stockade Branch, became contaminated. And since many of these new prisoners had arrived already sick and weak from their time in Richmond, the first death took place only days after they got there, when on February 27th, Adam Swarner of the 2nd New York Cavalry succumbed to pneumonia. Swarner was the first of almost 13,000 prisoners to lose their lives at Andersonville. If this early setback wasn't enough, that first group of prisoners' excitement over space quickly evaporated as approximately 400 more men arrived at the prison daily over the next few months. And by June of 1864, over 26,000 prisoners were confined in a stockade that was designed to house only 10,000. But this wasn't even the worst of it. At its most crowded near the end of that sweltering Georgia summer, the prison population swelled to 32,000. Now, with so much overcrowding, I personally find it hard to even comprehend the scale of the tragedy that took place there over the following years. These were horrors that came in a number of different ways. Some that could have been prevented, some possibly unforeseen, and others just likely might have been intentional. First of all, the prison had no barracks or buildings of any kind, so The men were forced to fend for themselves, crafting rudimentary tents and shelters from scavenged wood, blankets, and clothing. Those who didn't have the means to do this had to dig into the ground and carve out crude holes to sleep in at night for protection. Yet no one, no matter what they had for shelter, could escape the relentless swarms of rats, lice, and fleas that resulted from the overcrowding, much less the mosquitoes and unforgiving extremes of Georgia's climate. Whether that be the oppressive heat and humidity, or the sudden, heavy downpours. Sergeant Samuel Corthell, who served in Company C of the 4th Massachusetts Cavalry, described the grim conditions at Andersonville pretty vividly.
The camp was covered with vermin all over. You could not sit down anywhere. You might go and pick the lice off of you and sit down for a half a moment and get up, and you would be covered with them. In between these two hills, it was very swampy, all black mud, and where the filth was emptied, it was all alive. There was a regular buzz there all the time, and it was covered with large white maggots.
As you can expect from this, disease spread quickly through the prison's population, exacerbated by contaminated water and substandard food. Diarrhea, fevers, dysentery, and scurvy were rampant, and even minor wounds were prone to infection, threatening lives with gangrene and necrosis. It was a small tent hospital outside the stockade, but just like everything else at Andersonville, it too struggled with supply issues. So the sheer number of afflicted meant that the most a prisoner could really hope for there was a dry, clean cot where they could pass away in peace. Of course, aside from illness and infection, starvation was one of the leading causes of death. Even when a sufficient quantity of rations was available, it was of poor quality and inadequately prepared, leaving thousands to suffer day in and day out from extreme hunger. There were so few rations that even the Confederate guards frequently went hungry. Private Slaxon of the 9th Minnesota Cavalry described the hopelessness he witnessed among the men of Andersonville.
The sight of all this misery, the starved, dying, and half-naked humans all around, those with scurvy, misshapen limbs, swollen joints, and festering sores infected with gangrene, all contributed to make the newcomer so unnerved that he would soon get into a mental condition of despair, out of which the ghost beacon of death seemed welcome.
More than 45,000 Union soldiers were imprisoned at Andersonville during the 15 months that it was in operation, and 12,912 of them never made it out. These men were buried in rows in a cemetery next to the camp, hallowed grounds that remain to this very day, preserved and honored as a National Historic Site that's operated by the National Park Service. But of all the horrors to take place within the walls of that stockade, tragedies that should never be forgotten, the event that took place on July 11, 1864, has become the most infamous in the minds of many.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
The horrific conditions and tremendous loss of life at Andersonville Prison will forever be remembered as one of the most gruesome aspects of an already violent conflict. However, over the years, the story of the misery at Andersonville has often been overshadowed by the tale of six men who were hanged there on July 11, 1864. Individuals who were members, or possibly even the leaders, of a violent gang that terrorized their fellow prisoners. They were known simply as the Andersonville Raiders. By June of 1864, the population of the prison had surpassed 21,000 Union soldiers, more than double its intended capacity. And due to the desperate conditions that arose from the overcrowding, fighting among these men was common. Mostly, it was over food or equipment, but just like you'll see in any community with a large enough population, there was a rise in criminal behavior as well, with theft and violence escalating every day, and in some cases, it wasn't even just as a means for survival, as you'd expect under these circumstances, but rather for profit. These perpetrators were dubbed raiders, and depending on who you ask, these particularly violent gangs numbered anywhere from 100 to 700 men who operated both as individuals and in groups, preying upon their fellow prisoners and forcing them to hand over their meager rations or supplies or maybe even luxury items under the threat of violence. Union soldier John McElroy, who survived Andersonville, published his experiences at the notorious prison in 1879, offering a first-hand account of this notorious gang.
They formed themselves into bands numbering from 5 to 25, each led by a bold, unscrupulous, energetic scoundrel. We now call them raiders, and the most prominent and best known of the bands were called by the names of their ruffian leaders, as Mosby's Raiders, Curtis's Raiders, Delaney's Raiders, Sarsfield's Raiders, Collins' Raiders, etc. The methods of the raiders were various, ranging all the way from sneak thievery to highway robbery. All the arts learned in the prisons and purlieus of New York were put into exercise. Decoys would be on the lookout for promising subjects as each crowd of fresh prisoners entered the gate, and by kindly offering to find them a sleeping place, lure them to where they could be easily despoiled during the night. If the victim resisted, there was always sufficient force at hand to conquer him, and not seldom his life paid the penalty of his contumacy. I've known as many as 3 of these to be killed in a night, and their bodies, with throats cut, her skulls crushed in, be found in the morning among the dead at the gates. All men having money or valuables were under continual espionage, and when found in places convenient for attack, a rush was made for them. They were knocked down, and their persons rifled with such swift dexterity that it was done before they realized what had happened.
Stories eventually emerged that the raiders had become so bold that they were even committing crimes in the daylight hours, attacking the weak and loners, and then escaping into the crowd for safety. And as we heard McElroy express, rumors even began to circulate through Andersonville that the men were outright murdering other prisoners, further fueling fear within the camp. By most accounts, it seems that for several months during the spring and early summer of 1864, the raiders practically ruled the stockade, and as I mentioned, it wasn't just for survival.
The proceeds of these forays enabled the raiders to wax fat and lusty, while others were dying from starvation. They all had good tents constructed of stolen blankets, and their headquarters was a large, roomy tent with a circular top situated on the street leading to the south gate, and capable of accommodating from 75 to 100 men. All the material for this had been wrested away from others. While hundreds were dying of scurvy and diarrhea from the miserable insufficient food and lack of vegetables, these fellows had flour, fresh meat, onions, potatoes, green beans, and other things the very looks of which were a torture to hungry, dysenteric men.
By the end of June, the Union soldiers had enough, and an organized group of men known as the Regulators approached their Confederate captors about dealing with these criminals, asking for permission to establish an internal police force, which was granted. So the Regulators acted fast, hunting and arresting what purportedly was about 75 men who were then subjected to court-martial proceedings in early July. Many were found guilty, and they were punished by, quote, running the gauntlet, which consisted of them proceeding through two lines of soldiers, beating them with sticks and clubs. But six of them were found guilty of acts so heinous, they were sentenced to death by hanging on July 11, 1864, which, according to author Gary Morgan, was, quote, the most witnessed execution in U.S. history. Over the next century and a half, when Andersonville was nothing more than a memory, the legend of the Raiders grew in popularity, often taking center stage to any discussion about the prison itself. But as Morgan writes in the 2020 book, Andersonville Raiders, Yankee vs. Yankee in the Civil War's Most Notorious Prison Camp, aside from the hanging itself, little can actually be confirmed about what happened inside those stockade walls.
Like a 19th century game of telephone, where a whispered sentence becomes more and more unrecognizable with each repetition, the details surrounding those six men and their deaths were obscured by perspective, memory, and exaggeration. Witnesses who wrote about the incident disagreed on the crimes that led to the execution, the role the prison officials played, specific details about the trial, and subsequent hanging.
As a result, for years, the actions of the Andersonville Raiders became the central story when it came to telling the history of Andersonville. But as the National Park Service claims on their website, quote, the overemphasis on the Raiders has created an impression that the Raiders define the Andersonville experience. But the simple truth is that these Raiders' reign and influence was very short-lived. So the question is, how and why did this happen?
Raiders were often emphasized because they were a safe story to tell that would not incite sectional divisiveness. Northerners could talk about the Raiders as being rogue immigrants and that good patriotic American soldiers didn't commit such atrocities. Southerners could talk about the Raiders as being a source of the troubles at Andersonville and deflect attention away from the prison's other issues. For authors and movie producers, the Raiders provided an action-packed drama that made for better storytelling than a mass of sick prisoners.
Andersonville Prison ceased operation in May of 1865. And as we discussed before, Captain Henry Veers, the commander of Camp Sumter, who assisted the Regulators and even ironically approved the Raiders' hanging, was found guilty and executed himself for, quote, murder in violation of the laws of war. Today, the Andersonville National Historic Site not only preserves the legacy of the nearly 13,000 men who lost their lives at the notorious prison, but is also home to the National Prisoner of War Museum, several monuments, the Georgia World War II Heritage Trail, and of course, the Andersonville National Cemetery, a 27-acre site about 300 yards away from the original prison site. But this historic burying ground would not be the same today if it were not for the efforts of Dorrance Atwater of the 2nd New York Cavalry, a prisoner at Andersonville who had been paroled to work in the hospital in the summer of 1864. There, he diligently kept a record of all the prisoners who died at the prison. And when the war ended, he reached out to Nurse Clara Barton, the, quote, angel of the battlefield, for assistance in contacting the families of those fallen prisoners of war. Barton had already taken it upon herself to go through the painstaking process of documenting all of the missing or dead soldiers from the war. But now, with the help of Atwater, she was able to assist the U.S. Army in accurately identifying 95% of the thousands of graves there and provide comfort to an untold number of families whose loved ones never returned home. Throughout the Civil War, over 400,000 prisoners were captured between the North and South, and about 50,000 of them died in captivity. But of that number, about 25% of those who lost their lives did so at the notorious Andersonville Prison, leaving no doubt that this horrifically overcrowded and undersupplied camp was the deadliest ground of the American Civil War. My name is Brandon Schecksnyder, and you are listening to Southern Gothic. Southern Gothic is an independent podcast made possible by listeners like you. Today's episode was written and produced by Brandon Schecksnyder, with additional research by Brianne Schecksnyder. If you'd like to hear ad-free episodes of this show, links are in the show notes for how to do so in absolutely every podcast player you can imagine. Of course, if you'd also like some bonus content from this episode, like historic images of Andersonville or a video wrap-up, head over to patreon.com/southerngothicmedia. And become a valued supporter of Southern Gothic. And y'all, as always, thanks for listening.
Lucky Lady Shacks.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.